So what does befall mean? I think this is also going to add to this question, because the whole concept around the fall is this concept about a separation, that there's some a gap that needs to be bridged, a door that needs to be opened in such a way. So let me start off with kind of just giving a quick overview of how I think most of us have come to recognize that meta-narrative and how I understood it, and then just go through the simple process of a simple process that only took about 15 years of how my mind changed about what it actually means and how I interpret it now. The way I understood the story is when God first created this world, everything was perfect, and there was this Eden, this paradise, in which there was no sin, no death. It was all as He meant it to be, and the first people who were perfect as well could have lived in this naked bliss forever if they didn't go and mess it up. But somehow they ate from the wrong tree. There was only one tree that they weren't supposed to eat from. They ate from it. And the perfection, the deathlessness, the sinless creation, the perfection in that sense was lost as a result of that event. And the curse came upon the earth and upon us. And so Jesus came and kind of helped us with some of the stuff, but it's not quite back to what it was supposed to be. Death is still around. Sin is still, things are still not quite perfect, but we have the hope that, you know, by following Jesus, we one day going to go back to that original perfection. So most of you are familiar with that story. It's part of the meta-narrative that we've learned. And so, number one, I quickly want to look at the implications of understanding the meta-narrative in that way. And then I'm going to say why my mind started changing about it and how. So I think one of the implications is we start living in, first of all, in a sense of lack, because where we are now is not really what it was meant to be originally. Who I am now is not quite as good as it could have been. So the whole situation now leads to a nostalgic longing for a lost perfection. And we can start accessing it through Jesus, but it's still either far in the past or far in the future, and we try and kind of glimpse at portions of that idyllic paradise. It's somewhere there. So the things that changed my mind, how can I summarize it? It's actually such a good exercise to take like weeks of lectures and put it into a 15-minute summary. But I think one of the first things is appreciating the intention of the authors of the scripture. So when I started looking at what and studying a simple thing like when was Genesis written, most of us read it, you know, it's the first book in the Bible, it's probably written first. But have you ever wondered why no one else in the Old Testament mentions Adam or Eve or the fall? Now, Jeremiah doesn't say to his city, hey guys, you need to stop your sinning, your injustice. Oh, sorry, no, I remember, you can't help yourself. Adam and Eve messed up. And that's, you're just sinful by nature. So, sorry, I take it back, carry on. Just try and tame it a little bit. The guys never do that. They just say, stop sinning. You know, stop your injustice. Stop doing this. It's wrong. And none of them refers to the fall as an excuse for where they act. And the reality is that there was no developed theology of original sin or the fall throughout the Old Testament. This might surprise you, but the doctrine of the fall only came into being after the resurrection. It's Romans 5 that spurred the first thoughts. It's Paul's ideas that first kind of gave this idea that there was one event in which things went wrong. And it's and Augustine took it further. But prior to that, so there was no understanding of an original sin, the fall of humanity. Jews today still read that text and they don't know what we're on about the fall. That's not what we intended this story to mean. And so, obviously, things went wrong in our world, but let me start off by saying, what was the story intended to communicate originally? And if we understand that, then maybe we'll understand what Paul was trying to do a bit better, and then maybe, you know, it can expand our understanding of the meta-narrative. So the story, the Genesis origin myths are quite late in their origin. That's why the other authors doesn't refer to it, because they didn't know about it. It did not exist. And so most scholars who will have a critical review of text would agree that the Genesis narratives probably came about, well, most of the scriptures was brought together during the Babylonian exile. So many of the, that is between 586 BC and 530 BC, around about there. That is the time where both Israel and Judah, two different kingdoms, are brought into exile in Babylon. They've had their stories mostly orally given to one another since about 1000 BC, during the time of David and monarchy. Then some of the stories gets written down. But now for the first time, where both these kingdoms are brought into exile in Babylon, and most nations lose their sense of identity because they now become slaves, there is for the first time the motivation to preserve their stories, their tradition, and they actually collate stories from both Judah and Israel. Why is it important that it's both Judah and Israel? There's two very strong sources. In fact, in the Pentateuch, first five books of the Bible, every story is repeated twice. There's two creation stories, two stories of Abraham, two stories of Isaac, two stories of the flood. Everything's repeated twice. And the one story refers to God as Yahweh, and the other story refers to God as Elohim, up until the stage where God reveals his name as Yahweh to Moses. So they call it the Yahweh source and the Elohim source. So two very distinct sources that we don't see in our text. We just read Lord or Lord God. But one story is written, they know God as Elohim. And the other story is written, same story, but they know God as Yahweh. And very distinct, the different stories. They don't just know God by different names until that event with Moses. They also have different priesthoods. It's the priesthood of the Levites and the priesthood of the Aaronites. And when you read the Aaronites' version of the Levites, it's not very complimentary. And when you read the Levites' stories about the Aaronites, they're the guys who make false gods and who makes golden calves. And it's not very complimentary either. So these two distinct sources are now brought together, the texts are collated, and they actually integrate the texts and the stories. It's very interesting. There's a book, Who Wrote the Bible, that goes through all of it. And he actually has a Bible that's color-coded in the different sections. And you can take a story like the flood, which they have really interlaced it almost sentence for sentence, the two different versions of the story. You can read the red version and it makes perfect sense from beginning to end. And it's almost every second sentence. You can read the blue section and it makes perfect sense as a story self-contained. But in our text, it's just a story that's been collated like that. And so when I started studying who wrote the text, when was it written, why was it written, I then also started understanding that origin myths was very much a part of the Babylonian exile in which they found themselves. Enuma Elish, which is basically the Babylonian version of when God began creating. That is their origin myth. And in this myth, there's chaos in the beginning, and there's Marduk, one of the gods, fights against Tiamut. Tiamut is the evil personification of the unformed waters. And Marduk sends a wind into Tiamut and he blows her body apart, and in that way he saves all the other gods and a new creation begins. But behind those myths is a very definite political message as well, because mankind is then created later on to serve the gods, and their message is clear: violence is creative. It is through a creative act of violence that we bring about a new order. And humanity is created to serve the gods. And it's in this atmosphere in which all the Israelites are told, you were created to serve. You were created to remain in the order that you are in. And if you cause any chaos, we know how to deal with that. Through a creative act of violence, we will annihilate you. But we will retain the status quo. And so most of the origin myths was written by the elite, the ruling parties, the people who could write, to reinforce their order, to reinforce the status quo. And so it's within this context in which Israel and Judah have now merged, are starting to bring their texts about, that they write a story that everyone in Babylon would have recognized. It sounds the same. It begins the same. When God began creating, there was chaos. And we don't see it in our English text, but where we've got, there was darkness on the face of the deep. That word that we've translated, the deep, is the Hebrew equivalent of the name Tiamut. There was darkness on the face of Tiamut, the deep. And Elohim sends a wind. It's like all the aspects of the story that they're familiar with are present in this story, yet it starts saying something radically different both about God and man. In the first place, God brings order out of this chaos, not through violence, but he brings order by bringing greater and greater distinction within this disorder. And so in the first 3 days, he creates three different spaces. He separates the space of light from darkness. He separates the waters above from the waters below. He separates the land from the waters. And then the next 3 days, he fills those spaces. And so it's only on the fourth day that the sun and the stars, the sun is placed in the light. So there was light before there was sun. And the stars and the lesser lights are put into the darkness, into the night, to give light then. And then he fills the skies with birds, the earth with the sea with animals, and lastly the land with animals and ourselves. And so this gives a picture of a God who doesn't create through violence, but the God who's creative through his word and through bringing distinction and bringing order in that way, who can creatively reorganize the chaos to bring about something beautiful and new. But ultimately what it says is you were not created to be slaves. And so this text, when it was originally written, was radically irreligious. This was heretical. This wasn't a religious text at all. This was subversive of the religion that was predominant in their time, because they have a vision of a God who invests his own image and likeness in humanity. A humanity that's not just meant to be used and abused, but the humanity that is to be honored and valued as God's image himself. And that was radically subversive in their culture. And so that's just a little bit of overview to kind of say that when I started understanding the context of when this text was written, I still held for a long time the view, okay, there's some beautiful metaphorical lessons I can learn from Genesis, there's some beautiful other images I can see from it, but it's still a very definite historic event. And I held that view for a long time. Slowly I moved over to a place where I realized that maybe none of it ever happened. Maybe there never was a talking snake. Maybe there never was magical trees that could bestow gifts of knowledge and wisdom on people. Maybe maybe the author couldn't make it more plain than what he did when he said, "This is the tree of the knowledge of good and evil." In other words, if he just came out and said, "Guys, this isn't a real tree. What I'm trying to say is if you partake of a certain knowledge, it has got certain consequences." But if he had to do that, he would lose the poetic power of what he was communicating. Specifically, if you recognize this, that these stories originate before text. Okay, so we've got to tell a story in such a way that the village idiot can remember it. Because you want this, you want this story to survive from generation to generation, and we don't have a written text, so we've got to make it as fantastic, as exciting, as memorable as possible. So we've got to reinforce the ideas with images. So the idea of a certain kind of knowledge that can pervert your desires. We use the image of this tree. Now we have been traditionally, so it's interesting, you know, Genesis 1 is an Elohim source. In the Elohim source, throughout the Old Testament, there's no talking animals. There's no mythical images. They are quite the Elohim source, because it's also written later. They are sternly against the mythological images that is prevalent in their community, and so they removed it completely and utterly from their text. There's nothing that could give people a sense of magical things is still real. But the Yahweh source, that's still much more free in the expression it uses and the images it uses to communicate its images. So whatever needs to talk will talk, whether it's a donkey, an image, a snake, or whatever needs to talk to get the message across, they will use it. And so Genesis 1 until chapter 2 verse 4 refers to God as Elohim. 2 verse 4 onwards, Lord God. Elohim Yahweh. So they've identified that El, who's known throughout that region as God, El is Yahweh. So when we get to what does the fall mean now? So first of all, how did the original authors, what was the question they asked? Because we go to that text with the question, what went wrong? And our question determines the boundaries of the meaning that we can find from that text. We look for, and it opens up a lot of other questions. First of all, it's filled with assumptions. Assumption number one, something went wrong. Assumption number two, this text is the historic account of what went wrong. Assumption number three, before the things went wrong, everything was perfect. You know, we come to it with all those assumptions that's in that question of what went wrong. But if we change the question and we say, what was the intention of the authors? It seems like many of the Hebrew scholars, Jewish thinkers, and many Christian even theologians these days are moving towards, and this is not, they're not just moving towards this now, they're moving towards it because they also go and study the ancient thoughts about what did this text mean. And one of the things they are saying is the question that was asked or addressed is more what makes us human than the question of what went wrong. So this is a text that explores the birth of human consciousness. What is it that makes us uniquely human? And if you read it in that way, then suddenly Genesis 2 and 3, and many people have read it that way, can, in terms of child psychology even, it can be the story of every human being. In every person's life, every one of us has grown up in a situation where somewhere in our development there was a whispering voice that says, you lack something. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's kind of this knowledge that is suggested to Eve. You are not like God. You know, and when God is portrayed as someone that withholds, the very way in which desire works is, I want what is withheld from me. Imagine a group of teenagers having a party and you walk in with a box full of goodies and you say, I'm just leaving this on the table here. I'm popping out for an hour or two. Please don't have anything in there, especially not that chocolate cake in the middle. And you come and we just know that that's going to be gone and no one knows where it went. And so if the Genesis 2, 3, etc. is history, then it opens up a whole lot of difficult questions. Why the heck create the tree of the knowledge of good and evil? Why put it in a place where they can access it so easily? At least put it at the top of a mountain. Make the fruit ugly. Make it bitter. Do something to keep us from partaking. But no, this tree smack dab in the middle, the fruit is amazingly attractive, and there's even somebody that helps point out how delicious it is, you know. Why, God, couldn't you have made a better plan? And so the historic reading of it opens a whole lot of legitimate questions of why. Surely we think we can devise a better plan of keeping us from partaking of that fruit. And so I have eventually come to the conclusion, firstly because of my love of the text, and because I went and read further and I discovered that there has always been different readings of the text that for me has carried much more meaning than just the historic reading of it. I have come to that conclusion that it is not historic, and that as I say, I quickly summarize what has happened over decades, because I didn't realize how deeply embedded the historic version of that story was in me. Now, why is that important? It opens up a whole new world of meaning. Also, secondly, something that influenced me is I found many of the scientific arguments quite convincing. So things like death has always been necessary for life. There's never been, of all the evidence we know of how life works, life is impossible without death. The very fact that there's life on this planet is because our sun is dying. And the small fraction of its death reaches us every day. And it is that death that makes life possible on this earth. And bacteria dying is what makes the nutrition in the soil possible. And the nutrition, the death of that bacteria is what makes the life of plants possible. And the death of that plants is what makes animal life possible. And all life is dependent on death. And so I'm trying to summarize this whole thing. What does it mean? And what does the fall mean? So I'm going to touch some bits here and there, and hopefully we add some insight amongst many more questions. But if I only stir questions, I hope it's exciting questions. Because, you know, yeah. Questions are exciting. You know, they can lead you into so many directions, whereas answers, they are just what they are. You know.